is up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of our FanCast Movies podcast. We're a podcast about movies, and you can find us on Fandangle.com. We're also on Movies.com. Myself, Eric Davis, at Eric Davis on Twitter, and my co-host, Sean O'Connell, is at Sean underscore O'Connell on Twitter. Sean, we're at that exhausting part of December, where we've just watched movie after movie after movie, and it's like it's just starting now. Golden Globe nominations were this morning. How are you doing, mentally and physically? I'd like to know.
I'm doing fine. This season, for whatever reason, hasn't felt like too much of a crunch. It almost feels like I was successful in seeing a lot of the awards contenders early so that I didn't have to. And by early, I mean like 2 weeks ago, maybe, 3 weeks ago. So I didn't have to cram all of them into the last few days, before the year ends. For people who don't know, Eric and I vote in different organizations, and it's similar to the way that you hear these Golden Globe nominations coming out or the Oscars eventually, where you have to watch everything by the end of the year, or really before the holidays sort of kick into high gear so that everything that's eligible sort of screens. And, back in the day, when studios would really hold on to their awards contenders, we would average like two movies a day, and they'd be, two Oscar contenders back to back, and you'd be cramming all these different things in. This week we had like The Hobbit on a Tuesday night and then Wolf of Wall Street on Wednesday morning, and they're both near 3 hour movies. And so that's a bit of a challenge, but it's been easier to sort of keep everything filtered and know what I think is going to contend and what I hope will surprise a few people.
Yeah. As the guy at home who's sipping his Campbell's soup right now is like, I feel bad for you guys. You have to watch movies. I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
Your life sucks.
Everyone was complaining. They're like, oh, I hate the Golden Globes for making me get up so early and cover this. And I was like, yeah. So the construction guy who's on his way to his job in the freezing cold. Just shut up,
at 4:30 in the morning. Right. But yeah, it's been a busy week. Not only are a lot of the awards movies screening for critics around the country, not only are the Golden Globe nominations and SAG nominations were this week as well, but we're also beginning to see the previews for the big 2014 movies, namely the summer movies. This week alone. And next week, too. We're getting a lot of trailers, too. But this week, Amazing Spider-Man 2, Godzilla, Edge of Tomorrow.
Right.
So we're starting to see some of these big movies, and we're going to talk about those as well, and we're going to talk about The Hobbit. But let's start off first, because Golden Globe nominations were this morning. It's hard to just skip over them and pretend they didn't happen, because they did. That ship did dock this morning. And, I have to say this. A lot of people give the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, they're the ones who vote on the Golden Globes. A lot of people give them flack for trying to stuff star-studded movies into their award show just so a lot of celebrities will be there. But you know what? There isn't a movie that they nominated that I wouldn't recommend seeing. I think they did a good job this year. And I want your brief thoughts, and then I want to ask you your biggest surprise, biggest snub.
Well, I totally agree with you in that there wasn't a glaring, oh my gosh, you can't nominate The Tourist, just because you want Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie to show up. And that was shameful.
Yeah, I think they learned that lesson with that.
Well, there was like Kate Winslet was there for Labor Day. And if that's your grab to have a celebrity in the audience, for a movie that very few people saw, then that's fine because she's actually pretty good in it. So I'm okay with that. So nothing stood out as like, oh, get that off your list. And in fact, there's a lot of people like Greta Gerwig for Frances Ha and Julia Louis-Dreyfus for Enough Said, who I didn't think they would get recognition, and I'm really happy to see them get nominated. The biggest snub to me was The Butler, which just seemed to get shut out of everything.
It did
really well with SAG the day before, and I think it has some. It's really funny, this roller coaster ride of, I'm sure the producers for Lee Daniels' movie, they were like, look at all these SAG nominations, we're in business. And then the next day it's like Golden Globes, you go 0-for, and you're like, oh God, what happened? How did this, from one day to the next? But I think it's going to be fine. I think the Academy will come around and nominate it in a few different categories. But to go 0-for at SAG's at Golden Globes, I was very surprised. Especially, don't they want Oprah in that room? For God's sakes, put Oprah in the room.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it was a pretty big snub. Also, Saving Mr. Banks, not anywhere. And I think Rush and Philomena probably got those nominations instead.
Well, and because it's the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, and so I think when you give them an F1, you know, European racing movie, they're going to lean on that more than they will a civil rights movie for American history, which they don't care about. Now, I say that, but like then a movie like Nebraska and then Inside Llewyn Davis, I mean, these are as American, you know, heartland movies as you can kind of get, and they still got nominations. So it's hard to tell. I mean, there's only a few members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, not a ton. And they all vote on the Golden Globe nomination. So these are the movies that spoke to them.
Yeah, and I like it. And you mentioned the Winslet before. That was a surprise for me. And I think it probably surprised the studio too, because I haven't gotten really any awards stuff for Labor Day. I don't think they really considered it an awards contender. And then all of a sudden, boom, Kate Winslet pops up with the nomination, and the movie's not even screening for critics. So yeah, I think it kind of – everybody did a double take on that, but I like it. I think she delivers a really devastating performance in that film. We spoke about it at Toronto. It definitely goes for those emotional heartstrings, but she's really good in the film, and it's a different role for her, and I really liked it. So I'm glad that at least she's on the radar and that film is on the radar, because it's not a film that should be hidden. It's really good.
Did you have a big snub or a big surprise?
Did I have a big snub? You know, I was surprised to see Rush nominated. I guess not so surprised considering this Hollywood Foreign Press. But, you know, here's a movie that kind of nobody's really been talking about ever since, you know, it opened. People were hot on Daniel Brühl, but nobody really kind of factored it into the equation. And look, and it shows up. And it gets a Best Picture Drama nomination. Daniel Brühl, again, after a SAG nomination, gets nominated. So I think it's really nice for him as an actor. And
I think it puts Brühl right back in the conversation. I mean, he was a sort of front runner when that movie was playing, and then some people were like, maybe Jake Gyllenhaal, maybe someone else is going to step in here. But with, you know, SAG nominations and a Golden Globe, I think that puts him in the driver's seat.
It does put him in the driver's seat, you know. And if I had a biggest snub, it would probably be on the television side. I'm really pissed off Game of Thrones did not get anything, because I thought this past season was the best season. But you know what? This isn't a TV podcast, Sean, so I shouldn't even have said that.
Yeah, but your boy Scorsese gets snubbed. And, you know, David O. Russell doing his best Scorsese impersonation gets in, but the master himself gets left out of the cold.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And I don't want to go too much into that, because there are a lot – everybody's really mixed on American Hustle. And I am one who really likes it. And I remember walking out of The Wolf of Wall Street, and a very well-known film critic turned to me and said, I think David O. Russell just out-Scorsese'd Scorsese. Mm-hmm. And some, you know, some people are just feeling like American Hustle is the better Scorsese movie. But I mean, you know, I to each their own, you know, and it'll be interesting. You'll see what I did with those two movies on my top 10 list that when I write it for next week. But moving on, Sean.
Yes.
Trailers.
Yes.
Big. I mean, look, we're at the end of December. 2014 is around the corner. And before you know it, we are going to be revving up our engines for the summer of 2014, and which is kind of interesting, you know. And I told somebody recently, and we're going to have podcast after podcast analyzing the summer of 2014 as it gets closer, but everybody's talking about the summer of 2015 as being like the craziest summer on record ever in the history of cinema. But 2014, I feel like, is a riskier summer, because you have a lot of these interesting movies that aren't as well known. You have movies like Edge of Tomorrow, even Godzilla, and you have some interesting science fiction. You have some cool little different movies that may be a little unexpected. So I think to the summer of 2014, I don't know, I think it's a little bit more interesting than the summer of 2015, but we'll see. But let's talk about these three trailers.
Well, if anybody's listened to our podcast before, you know that we're big fans of the Spider-Man franchise. So we'll table that discussion for a little bit and talk about some of the ones that might have surprised us. And for that, I'm going with Godzilla. The Godzilla remake, which is coming out in – is it June? I should have looked up the date.
I think it's at the end of May.
End of May? Okay.
Middle of May. Maybe the Robin Hood spot.
It's been around for a little while. I mean, they teased it at Comic-Con 2 years ago and then rolled it out again, you know, this past year. They wanted to remount Godzilla, you know, for a long time. And so they got Gareth Edwards to helm this remake. And I am leaning towards the Godzilla trailer being my favorite one that I saw this week, because I thought it did, you know, what a trailer should do in terms of picking your interest but not giving away too much. The Spider-Man trailer, I thought, showed a lot. You know, it was just a sort of explosion of action and character and ideas. The Godzilla remake spends so much time just putting you in the point of view of these paratroopers, you know, who are diving into a situation where they're being told that we can't tell you what's going to happen. It could get bad. And then you get the slight reveal of the creature and the roar that tells you it's Godzilla. To me, that's a great trailer. It picks your interest just enough, but it's not inundating you where you feel like you saw the entire thing. And it's a montage of the cast. The cast is really bizarre. I mean, Bryan Cranston in anything, great. Juliette Binoche in a Godzilla movie, I mean, okay, sure. Ken Watanabe's in it. Elizabeth Olsen. I think it's setting itself up to be one of the most interesting summer blockbusters we see. But of course, everybody is going to come and see, what does Godzilla look like? Does he look like the Roland Emmerich version? Does he look like the old man in the rubber suit? You know, we just don't know what to expect from it, and I think this trailer set it up without giving too much away.
Yeah, especially after Pacific Rim,
yeah,
Cloverfield, you know, these monster movies. It's like, what can you give us that's different? We already know Godzilla, and so yeah. I mean, look, the eclectic cast. Hey, Emmerich's Godzilla, Matthew Broderick, Hank Azaria. That cast was a little weird too. So I guess Godzilla movies like their weird eclectic casts. But my whole thing, yeah, I like the trailer. I think it looks great. But what else are we going – what else can you give us now beyond soldiers attacking a monster, people crying, people having to leave their houses because this monster's attacking? What else is there to tell us about, you know, what can this Godzilla movie introduce in terms of a monster movie that we haven't seen yet?
Yeah, I can understand that concern.
And that's where I'm at. So it's like – so I'm hesitantly – adoring it. I'm saying, look, I really like the way you did it. I don't know how these guys, what are they going to parachute on top of Godzilla and stick them with needles, but whatever. I think it's beautiful. I think it looks good. I think you have the right director for it.
Right.
But you need to convince me further that this is giving me something that I haven't seen yet. That's why I like the Edge of Tomorrow trailer. This is a Tom Cruise movie. It's based on a novel. It used to be called All You Need Is Kill. And it's an interesting concept. It's like Groundhog Day inside of an alien invasion movie, featuring Tom Cruise as this soldier who keeps reliving the day that he died fighting in this alien, I guess this war against the aliens. And through him reliving each day, he kind of figures out, okay, you know, instead of doing this, I should go do this, and this will lead me to that. And this, and then all of it, then we see a really rough and tough Emily Blunt in the film. And I think the trailer looks good. I'm on board for it. I tweeted something afterwards. I said, you know, I'm not a big fan of his beliefs, and I think he should see his kid more, but I am on board for every single Tom Cruise movie. I will watch the hell out of all of them.
Tom Cruise is 51. Someone tweeted after that trailer, he's the same age that Wilford Brimley was when he did Cocoon. That blows my mind, because he looks like he's 25 running around this trailer. It is action-packed. Cruise and sci-fi tend to go very well together. I liked Oblivion more than most people did, obviously Minority Report. It's a good concept. I worry that it reminded me too much of things like Source Code and things like Groundhog Day, where the guy has to keep reliving it and learning a little bit more as he goes. But the action looks intense. I mean, it's exoskeletons and it's huge explosions and it's crews just taking out aliens and, you know, obviously, yeah, I'm totally on board with it. Listen, you had me at Emily Blunt. Just stop. That's fine.
Yeah, and she's an interesting character. I think we're going to really see her as a female action hero. You know, this is an actress who I think she's kind of tried out for all those. The Black Widow, she's tried out for all those roles, and she hasn't really gotten any of them. And so I like her sort of finally getting her chance to kick some ass, and she's really good. And I saw somebody on Twitter, I think it was our friend Peter Hall over at Movies.com, who said, hey, if you ever do a Metroid movie, Emily Blunt,
yeah,
is the actress that you want for that. So I'm curious to see what that looks like. But yeah, I'm on board for it, and I like kind of these sorts of sci-fi movies. I think it should be interesting.
All right, so let's get into Spidey really fast. We're both, like I said, we're both fans of what Mark Webb has done so far in the franchise, and this trailer set up a lot. It set up you know, it's continuing from the story that Andrew Garfield and Mark Webb and Emma Stone are telling with young Peter Parker. But now that they've got the origin story out of the way, they can start moving forward. And it seems like the big focus of this new franchise moving forward to not only just Spider-Man Part 2, but 3 and 4 that have already been announced is that Oscorp is going to be the defining threat in Peter's life. We meet Harry Osborn, played by Dane DeHaan, and we learn that Oscorp has been tracking Peter, you know, over the course of his life because of research that his father did. And I was really surprised watching this how little Electro plays into this in the trailers for, because everything we know is that Electro is the main villain. It's Jamie Foxx and it's Electro, but we got a lot of Green Goblin in this. We got teases of the Rhino. You know, the overwhelming response from people who aren't really big fans of what Webb is doing so far was, it's Spider-Man 3, too many villains, you're cramming it, you know, filled with everybody. Did you feel that way, Eric, at all, or is that totally misguided?
I didn't really feel that way. I felt like this trailer was more setting up the next Spider-Man movie than it is this Spider-Man movie,
right,
you know?
Right.
And it's funny, this Spider-Man 2 trailer hit during a week that almost all of the studios showed their cards in terms of their expanded universes. Spider-Man 2, they were the first out of the gate with their trailer, and they said, look at our trailer. We're teasing other villains. We're teasing a Sinister Six movie. We're showing you how we're beginning to expand the Spider-Man universe throughout these next few movies. Batman vs. Superman said, oh, yeah, well, we got Wonder Woman hanging out now in our movie, and we're going to have some other DC characters. And so I feel like and then even Paramount said, oh, yeah, well, we got a Terminator movie, and we're doing a Terminator TV show that's going to tie into the movie. And so all the studios began, you know, revealing their plans for their own expanded universes with their characters. At the same time, Fox went and announced X-Men Apocalypse too. Oh, this is all in the span of like 3 days. These studios did this, which kind of bugged me out. But and it was almost like they were all following each other. But yeah, that's what when I saw this Spider-Man 2 trailer, that's what I see. I see them saying, look, we're not just showing you one movie. We're showing you a universe, and we're showing you how this movie is going to now set up our Spider-Man universe. So it's more like buy into the universe. But yeah, I agree with you. A lot of people have these scars from Spider-Man 3, and they're just like, ah. But you have to understand, Spider-Man 3 arrived at a time before Marvel started doing their thing. This is before anybody really had the chutzpah, so to speak, to do what Marvel did. But now, you see multiple villains in a movie, you know they're going to be taking a different approach with that. And that these villains are going to spill over into other movies. And we don't see a lot of Electro. I wouldn't be surprised if Electro is not just in this movie, but he's in the next one too. And maybe in the next one too.
Well, we talk about world building and we talk about creating these universes, you know, like it's a new thing. And yet poor Peter Jackson, he's like, hey, I've been building these Tolkien universes since I was 10 years old. You know, when am I going to get a little respect over here? I've got 1,400 Hobbit movies that you could choose from. Come on, everybody, take your pick. So let's get into the Desolation of Smaug. Because there's like 7 different versions that you can watch, whether you want 3D or IMAX or 48 frames per second. How did you see it? And give me your initial thoughts on the latest chapter of the second trilogy in the Tolkien adaptations.
I saw it in 2D. Which was very rare for me to see it in 2D. I picked an earlier 2D screening versus the later 3D screening. And, you know, I enjoyed it. I am one of these people who I did not read the Lord of the Rings books, none of them, didn't read The Hobbit. And I enjoyed the first Lord of the Rings trilogy. And I'm kind of, I guess I'm not coming at it from a hardcore fanboy's perspective and yelling, well, you didn't include this, or you're stretching out this. I'm just kind of going into each of these movies. I like hanging out in Peter Jackson's Middle Earth, and I feel really comfortable there. And these films, I liked The First Hobbit, and I like Desolation of Smaug. I think he kind of picks up the pace a bit in this second film, and he ties it more into the original trilogy. And yeah, there's still a lot of dwarves, and yeah, you're still not really going to know who any of them are. And Bilbo, who had a whole lot to do in the first one, with a much more profound emotional arc, is sort of set aside, cast aside in this film, as Jackson kind of weaves in other teases to the other Lord of the Rings franchise. And, you know, it doesn't feel like Bilbo's story, maybe in until the very end. But there are some really cool action sequences in there. There's an action sequence with involving barrels that I just had a blast with. And, you know, I'm on board. I think if you're a fan of the first one, you'll like this one better than you did that one. And if you're a Lord of the Rings fan in general, as long as you're not some cynical guy who just is coming in there wanting to hate it, I think you're going to like it. I don't know. What do you think?
It's wall-to-wall action. I mean, it really is. There's so much going on. My complaint is – well, I don't want to get into a complaint. When we finally get to Smaug inside the Lonely Mountains.
Smaug.
I mean, Jackson dragons like no one else has ever dragoned before. I mean, if you love dragons, if you have been waiting to see, you know, a dragon on the big screen.
If you're watching Game of Thrones and you're like, I need a freaking big dragon. Forget these little baby dragons.
Right.
Give me a big dragon.
Jackson gives you the dragon you've been waiting for your entire life.
Yeah.
And you're right. The barrel scene is hysterical. I mean, it's one of the most creatively choreographed action sequences I've seen in a very long time. And you're just laughing through it. Like, you're just giddy
I would say it was Tintin-esque. If you saw Tintin, which Peter Jackson was involved in, it was Tintin-esque. There's an action sequence in that film that reminded me very much of the one.
Now, there's a scene with spiders early on in this movie, mm-hmm. you know, giant spider. People know what this is. If you've read Tolkien, if you've read The Hobbit, you know what this is. At the end of The Hobbit, I felt like that spider scene was in, like, another movie I saw 2 years ago. I was like, wait, that was the same movie? Like, there's a danger of there being too much, you know? And listen, Jackson knows his audience, and they're clearly going to come out to it. The first Hobbit made over $1 billion worldwide, and they support what he does because they love what he does. And if you love that kind of storytelling, there's nobody doing it better right now. But I kind of punched out after, like, the Two Towers. And I was like, you know what? I love what you do, and I get it, but I don't really need to see these anymore. And it feels like there's just been too many of them since then. So
yeah. I mean, I don't know. You know, I don't agree because I like hanging out in Middle Earth. I just really like spending time there. And you can tell when you're there that you're there with a filmmaker who just – this is his home. And he adores it like nobody else. And all of that adoration is on the screen. And I feel that warmth. I feel that passion and love that he has for this fictional land, and I love spending time there. And you know what? People give Jackson crap for his films being too long, but specifically in A Desolation of Smaug, it allows him to linger on these action sequences. And you mentioned that big spider sequence, and in any other action movie, that's a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, we're out. But this one, it lingers, and it's a long sequence that has many different layers to it. Finally, when the elves, you know, finally elves show up, and there's just all these different layers to the sequence, and I'm saying to myself, same with the barrel sequence, I'm saying in any other action movie that's 100 minutes, you're not seeing these kinds of sequences because they don't have time.
Yeah, I agree with that. I definitely do agree with that. And the best part about it is because he's earned the type of money that he has earned with it, nobody's going to question his decision. Like, if he wants to linger on a scene and make it last for a long time, he's earned the right. He can do that. This is his franchise. This is his world.
Yeah, and I mean, I think some people are hopping on him saying, you know, that he felt the first franchise felt more I guess more practical effects. This one is a little bit more with the computer animated, especially with a couple of the orcs who are.
Oh, dude, I agree with that though.
I agree with that. I definitely agree with it, but it's not something that's completely pulling me out of the movie. And I see some of these reviews where all they do is talk about the CG effects, and I'm like, do you see the other movies that Hollywood puts out these days?
Yeah, right.
They're all full of CG effects, you know. And if you're gonna go see a movie like Pacific Rim and complain about, you know. Come on. But I mean, you know, it's still great. It's still it doesn't pull me out. I enjoyed it. I saw it
in the 3D. I want to talk about 3D because I thought the 3D, Jackson's one of the few people who really do make the most use of the technology. I didn't see it in 48 frames per second. I really do want to because I've heard that it has improved since the first time through. And I didn't even think it was really that big of a problem the first time through. I thought it was a really interesting way to view that universe. But the 3D is solid, especially with the dragons. I mean, it looks fantastic. And I would recommend going out of your way to probably try and see it in the 3D. Although, I mean, you did say the 2D was bright and really effective. So it's just so fascinating when Jackson puts something out there. He gives you all these different options, and you know, some people are going to go, they're going to double dip and try and see it in different ways.
Yeah, I enjoy it. I like watching a Peter Jackson movie, especially when he's playing around in the fantasy world. There's just nobody better that's doing it now at all. And you know, one thing that I am interested in, and we'll stop here, and because I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it,
yeah.
Gollum from the first one versus Smaug from the second one. I personally was a little bit more invested in the Gollum scene from the first one. I love, you know, we talk about the effects versus the first trilogy to the second trilogy, and feeling a lot more of the computer animated effects in this trilogy than we did in the first one. But Gollum, on the other hand, is a lot more menacing than he is in the first one. In the first trilogy, in this movie, and I like the Gollum stuff more than I did the Smaug stuff.
Oh, well, Gollum's just a more interesting character because it's so tragic. You know, he's so obsessed with the ring. And in fact, the stuff that really interested me in Desolation was Bilbo falling under the guise of the ring, you know, and really wanting to use it. And, you know, if it were up to me, I'd always wear that stupid ring. Because it's totally invisible, and he can do whatever he wants.
Sean would be walking into the Hobbit cheerleaders' dressing rooms wearing the ring.
Exactly.
I'll be right back, guys. You can go fight orcs. I'll be over in the Hobbit cheerleaders' dressing room.
With Smaug, it's like he's kind of just like playfully, you know, batting Bilbo around, you know. Because he's so much more powerful, and then obviously the way that it ends and sets up the third one, I think we're going to see a lot more of Smaug. But the story of Gollum and the way that he's obsessed with the ring and the way that it's ruining his life is, I thought, a way more interesting character arc.
Yeah, and you feel like the two of them in that scene, which is a really great scene from the first film, you feel like they're on more even ground. Kind of pitting their wits against each other, and I really liked it. And you know, people are crapping on the effects, but I think the effects for both Smaug and Gollum were exceptional in these two films.
Yeah,
and I really liked it. And so, I think it's a recommend from both of us.
Oh yeah, I would recommend it, especially if you like this kind of universe. I mean, that is definitely the quantifier. If you wave the white flag on Jackson's Hobbit universe, then you're probably not going to check it out. But if you love this kind of storytelling, especially with Game of Thrones and stories like that, there's, like you said, there's nobody doing it better than Jackson does it right now.
And there it is. So Sean, we're coming up on the end of December, and it's exciting. There's exciting times ahead. We're going to preview 2014, I think, maybe later this month or right in the beginning of January. We're going to talk about a lot of coming out in Christmas, too. There's a ton of these movies that are all being held for the end of the month, and I think I want to dive into those next week and kind of help people sort out which they should be seeing when their families are invading them over the holidays, because a lot of people are going to have their families, and they're going to be like, we got to go to the movies, and they're not going to know what to go see. So that's why we have to tell them, Sean.
Yes, and that's what we're here for, because Christmas and the holidays, they always get jam-packed with, you know, Oscar contenders and family films, and we have a lot to discuss.
Thank you very much for listening. His name is Sean O'Connell. My name is Eric Davis. We are both on Twitter. You'll find our Twitter handles in wherever you're listening to this. You'll find our Twitter handles there. This is the FanCast Movies Podcast. We are a podcast about movies, and I think we both thank you for listening to us, and go subscribe on iTunes, because we have a ton of episodes that we've recorded, and there's some really fun stuff in them, and maybe you can kill some time for a little while and listen to us ramble. Sean O'Connell, as always, thank you so much for joining me.
Always a pleasure.
You have a great weekend, and you at home have a great weekend at the movies.